Hi, welcome to another edition of the PCRF podcast. My name is Dave Page, and I'm here with
Dr. Aaron Burnett, the Assistant Medical Director for EMS at Regents Hospital.
And I'm Dr. Keith Wesley. I'm the Medical Director for Health East Medical Transportation in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And we're going to be talking about a very recent paper published in Pre-Hospital Emergency Care in 2012, Cardiac Movement Identified on Pre-Hospital Echocardiography Predicts Outcome in Cardiac Arrest Patients, by Dr. Achinger. I hope I'm not mispronouncing your name. I apologize if I am. The concept of this is whether or not you can use echocardiograms in the field, so ultrasound, to predict who will live and who will die, and what whether you should terminate efforts in the field. And they used echo here for 32 different patients and discovered that really only one survived to hospital admission if there was a cardiac standstill, and there was no survivors, I believe, to discharge. So the conclusion is that they are supportive of the idea of echocardiography as an additional criterion to decide who should or should not be, terminated, or who we should discontinue resuscitation efforts in the field. I was particularly interested in this because we saw a abstract being presented at NAMSP this year by a group, I believe, out of, I want to say, Pittsburgh. I hope will publish a full paper. I'm sure they will, with the CARES, the Cardiac Arrest Research database. And they looked at whether or not if you never got ROSC in the field, did any of those patients survive? And out of really thousands and thousands and thousands, there are very, very few that actually survive if you don't have ROSC in the field. However, even out of all those thousands and thousands, there were 81 patients who, without ROSC in the field, actually survived to hospital discharge neurologically intact. So the concept of getting better, in my mind, at identifying who is really dead and who we're, you know, no longer going to resuscitate is a great idea. And here we have the possible use of ultrasound out there. So, kind of controversial. What do you guys think?
Well, I mean, we use ultrasound in the emergency department quite a bit. I think it's a good tool. In the pre-hospital realm, I think looking at the heart is one of the more realistic and more reasonable reasons to use it. But it's an awfully expensive device, costs about $10,000 at least to get an ultrasound. And so you have the whole issue of prioritizing your funds. I know I'd like our ambulances to have a lot of devices that we don't necessarily have. Should it be ultrasound? Should it be Lucas? Should it be a video laryngoscope? I'm not sure this study's taken me over that hump to where it's worth allocating the funds to this device, which is only going to be used in very limited circumstances. We have a lot of ways to tell whether or not people are dead. Part of it is how they respond to your resuscitation over time. You know, even if you got this ultrasound picture, the heart moving or not moving, ultimately, if it doesn't make a pulse, then what difference does it really make? I think your fingers on that carotid artery is still the most important tool we have.
Oh, I'm going to be a little more aggressive than that. Dr. Afterheide, known to both of you and a good friend of this podcast, proved that we cannot feel pulses in low flow states. So what looks like PEA is actually not PEA. There's an actual pulse. There's a blood pressure. We just can't detect it with our fingers. So suddenly the thought that maybe the heart is squeezing becomes a great, and this paper would confirm it, a great predictor of whether or not we should be continuing the process. So, I mean, the fact that none of the other values that they looked at, whether it was capnography or age, bystander CPR, downtime, none of those were predictors of, or even asystole as an initial rhythm, none of them were found to be predictors, but,
So you nailed it. I think the time video ultrasound is the most useful is when you're trying to confirm, is this PEA or is this just a very hypotensive patient? If you've got VFib on the monitor after 30 minutes of resuscitation, or asystole for that matter, you don't need an ultrasound to tell that patient's still dead. But I agree, if you have an organized rhythm on your monitor and you're trying to determine, is this just profound hypotension, but there's still forward flow, or is this true electromechanical dissociation, if you will? I think ultrasound is vital in that specific instance.
And that really then brings up the point of, now not only is this it may be useful in cardiac arrest, which is a small subset of our responses, but a small subset of cardiac arrest. And to me, it was more of a feasibility study. It clearly worked, but who performed the echocardiography? Not paramedics, physicians. The level of training and education required to perform this skill. I think that that would be an extremely daunting challenge. I don't think that if you took this machine into the average emergency department across the country, whether the average ER physician could perform that skill.
If we took an entitled CO2 monitor and took it at every ER in the field, I want to see how many ER docs would be able to actually read waveforms and tell you what was going on.
But it's probably, as Dr. Wesley's saying, this is prioritization.
It's all about training.
Absolutely. Yeah. Training and how often you have to do this to stay up to date. How often are you going to have to do this so that your proficiency is maintained? And if you have providers who are willing to dedicate hours a week to maintain proficiency in this device,
hours
then I think it's
week.
Reasonable.
Well,
what we want to make life or death decisions.
We hook up the echocardiogram to telemetry or to a Da Vinci remote robot and have the physician teleoperate.
Okay,
let's
go
back
on the Star Trek thing here.
I'll come back to the study. When you made the comparison of issues of end-tidal CO2, they used the wrong end-tidal CO2. They compared initial entitle CO2s between survivors and non-survivors. I've seen that. You put the combi tube in, and the first few breaths, they both read in the 30s because you're just washing out dead air. I want to know what the entitled CO2 was at the time of the average echocardiogram. And in this study, the average first echocardiogram wasn't until 17 minutes into resuscitation. So if you want to compare apples to apples, then tell me what was the rhythm at that point? What was the end-tidal CO2 at that point? Not what was the presenting rhythm, not what was
all right,
the presenting end-tidal
CO2. I'll give you that. But I'm not going to give you this whole thing. You're both sort of sliding up on the table. It's just a very limited use. It's only for cardiac arrest, and we can't train paramedics to do it. So hogwash.
Yeah, we can do it for. We can look for ectopic pregnancies.
Great.
And
abdominal trauma.
We've
pericardial effusions for cancer patients.
We've definitely seen its use in trauma and in identification of blood in the abdomen. Okay, that was published by Hildebrandt and company and Hegard out of Minneapolis. So it's right next door, and they're continuing to use it. There are other uses for it. Seattle's using it to look for lung slippage. We discussed this whole issue with decompression of chests that are not being decompressed properly or even misidentified. So frankly, I think there's a mounting list of things, identification of fractures in pediatric patients. You can't just dismiss this as a single use device. And if both of you had the chance, you'd both want it in your doc emergency vehicle response units. Okay.
So you will have no trouble getting me to admit that ultrasound is a great tool. When I'm working in the ED, I use it constantly. I would say on 50% of my patients, they get some sort of ultrasound. But it takes a tremendous amount of energy to maintain your proficiency and to check for certain things pre-hospitally that aren't going to change care. You know, so you do an ultrasound and you confirm that this is a fractured ankle versus a sprained ankle. How's that going to change what you do when you're on the clinical shift?
Well, and the patient's refusing to go, and you say, boy, that's actually really broken. You're going to take him to the hospital, or else you're going to decide, you know, you probably could go to the urgent care center to get this x-rayed. But
are you going to not bill them for that transport because you gave them inaccurate? Or what if you tell them it's not fractured and sign them off, and then it is? Are you willing to take that liability?
Because
that's a huge step.
No, not at all. That's what I'm saying, is actually properly use it to properly triage people to go to a pediatric trauma center versus not a... multiple fractures in multiple spots make me think, okay, we're going to go to a different destination. I don't know, you guys.
What does this have to do with this paper?
Okay, fine. Let's just stop it. Thank you for tuning in to another edition of the PCRF Podcast.